I call this meeting to order. All the representatives of the commission are present. I'm Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis. I'm joined in person today, actually virtually today, by State Controller Malia Cohen. And we are also joined by Michelle Peralt, representing the Department of Finance. Madam Chair, Grace, do we have a quorum?
Madam Chair, we have a quorum present. In addition, I would like to identify the members of the staff of the commission participating virtually for this hybrid meeting today. We have Zoom co-host Mike Farina and meeting liaison Kim Lunetta.
Thank you. For the benefit of those in the audience, the State Lands Commission manages state property interests in over 5 million acres of land, including mineral interests. The commission also has responsibility for the prevention of oil spills at marine oil terminals and offshore oil platforms and islands, and for preventing the introduction of marine invasive species into California's marine waters. Today, we will hear requests and presentations involving the lands and resources within the commission's jurisdiction. I want to take a moment to acknowledge and express gratitude to the Nisenan, Wintun, Miwok, and Maidu people who have inhabited the Sacramento River Corridor, Valley, and Foothills for countless generations. I also want to take a moment to honor the California Native American communities all across the state for persisting, carrying on diverse cultural and linguistic traditions, and sustainably managing the land that we now share. Native people have maintained a constant presence on the landscape for many thousands of years, and they are essential stewardship partners, whether along the coast, along our rivers and valleys, or in our fragile deserts. We thank the Native American communities for participating in this commission's activities and for their essential role in maintaining and adding to our state's rich cultural legacy. The next item of business will be public comment. Before I open public comment period for items not on the agenda, first let me thank everyone, especially our stakeholders and members of the public, for taking the time to join our meeting. Now I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Cato to quickly share some instructions on how we can best participate in this meeting so it runs as smoothly as possible.
Thank you, Chair Kounoulakis. We will take public comment for a maximum of 30 minutes due to the extent of our meeting agenda. For public comment, we will ask those members of the public who are here in person first, and then hear comments from those of the members of the public who are participating virtually. We have a second public comment period at the end of our meeting for those who do not get called during our first public comment period. We will take those members of the public who are here in person first and hear comments from those members of the public who are participating virtually. If you would like to speak during either of our public comment periods, please or during a public comment period that is part of an agenda item, please complete an electronic request to speak form available on our homepage. We will call on you in the order in which you submitted the electronic request to speak. For those participating virtually, please make sure you have your microphones or phones muted to prevent background noise. To help us call on you through Zoom, please raise your hand during the appropriate comment section. First, if you are attending on the Zoom platform, please raise your hand in Zoom. If you are new to the Zoom platform and you've joined our meeting using the Zoom application, click on the hand icon at the bottom of your screen. When you click on that hand, it will raise your hand. Second, if you are joining via phone, you must press 9, not pound, but asterisk 9 on your keypad to raise your hand to make public comment. If you are calling in and want to view the meeting, please including the PowerPoint presentations, please view the meeting through the CalSpan Live webcast link. There will be a slight delay, but it will avoid an echo or feedback from using the Zoom application and your phone. We will call on individuals who have raised their hands in the order that they are raised using the name they registered with or the last three digits of their identifying phone number. After you are called on, you will be unmuted so you can share your comments. Please remember to unmute your computer or phone and identify yourself. Please keep your comments succinct and to the point and speaking on the item. Please keep your comments respectful and focused. We will mute anyone who fails to follow these guidelines, or worse, dismiss them from the meeting. I want to remind everyone that we have two general public comment opportunities, one at the beginning of the meeting and one at the end of the meeting. If anyone is having logistical or technical difficulties, please know you will have a second opportunity to provide comments at the end of the meeting. The commission has also established an email address to compile public comments for our meetings. Its address is cslc.commissionmeetings@slc.ca.gov. I've received various emails from parties that have been shared with all of the commissioners prior to the meeting. If we receive any emails during the course of the meeting, they will be shared with our commissioners as well and made available on our website at www.slc.ca.gov, along with the public comments emails we have already received. Chair Kunalakis, that concludes my hybrid meeting instructions, and we're ready to move to general public comment.
Thank you, Ms. Cato. I'm wondering if we should just quickly assess how many, roughly how many speakers do we have? Because if we're going to have a 30-minute limit on public comment, maybe we want to limit public comment to 1 minute, depending on how many folks we have signed up so we can hear from more people.
We currently have 15 commenters.
All right, then we can go ahead and do 2 minutes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
That doesn't mean that if people finish early, we can't, you know, take more. Okay, great. Wonderful. So the next order of business is the public comment period. If anyone would like to address the commission on any matter not on today's agenda, staff will call on those who are here in person first. Next, we'll move on to those joining us virtually. Katie, please call on the first person who would like to make a public comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For our first commenter is attending virtually, we have Peter Kaz, followed by Jennifer Creston.
Please proceed.
Mr. Kaz, if you're able to provide your comments, you should be able to unmute yourself now.
Sure. Thank you so much. Good morning, or actually good afternoon, Commissioner and staff. I'm Peter Kaz. Shore Moorings, I'm trying to talk about the Shore Moorings going, the rate hikes at Newport Beach. Just want to give a history. Shore Moorings are the places that boats are limited to 18 feet, and then they are roped to the shore, and then they all also, from the other side, they have anchored in the harbor with a fixed weight. In 2022, Newport Beach Harbor Master and Commission recommended huge increase in rate for shore moorings, which was about 1,200%. Next slide, please. In early 2024, they recommended the rates for the offshore mooring more than double, triple, and quadruple. We have 40-foot offshore moorings, which is the most common. The increase for them would be 360%. For a 70-foot mooring, the increase would be 532%. Let's see. And then also, the city is trying to eliminate our permits and then have our moorings as a private short-term renter, so they can even charge higher people who wants to use the mooring. Let's go to the last slide, please. So bottom line I'm trying to say is that the State Land Commission regulatory researches and set the benchmark for these state land usage. For the 45 feet moorings, they're asking to pay based on a state land, it's going to be 541, but the city is asking right now 1600, and eventually they're going to ask for 7200. So it's a huge increase, and please stop them. Please help us. This is discrimination against the mooring holder. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And before we move on to Jennifer Creston, who's attending virtually, we do have someone in person to provide comments, Brett Belint.
Hello, thank you. Can you hear me okay? Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Good afternoon. I wasn't scheduled to appear today. Some of my team asked me to come up. There's a matter that we've been working on in Arvin, California, which is a disadvantaged economic zone. It's a 200-acre, $50 million, a 50-megawatt project to power the town. It's all falling apart right now. The funder's about to walk because the CUC and the California Coastal, excuse me, the PG&E, the utility, are really messing this up. And it's supposed to put this for the people first, right? So this is for 5,000 homes, 20,000 people. And during the last 5 years where we're trying to get this done, they've had blackouts during the summer, 105 degrees. Aren't we supposed to be doing this for the people first, get the solar power in, help them, and not just let regulations get in the way? This is where we're at, and I'm really frustrated that I have to come down here when I have people working this for 5 years. So I want this one to be aware, and we're also inviting other candidates to come over there to try and push this project through. But the whole thing's going to fall apart right now, and I'm not here to see that happen. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Katie, next speaker, please.
Yes, thank you. We have Jennifer Creston, followed by Michael.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you, Jennifer. Please proceed.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners and staff. As you know, the city of Newport Beach is currently under review for its management of state tidal lands. Considering the significant staff departures from state lands in November and December of 2024, I'd like to relay to current staff how very thankful we are that their predecessors recognized some of the serious issues related to variations in rates, fees, and regulations that the city applies to different users of the very same public resource that is the tidal lands. For those now tasked with the management review, I wanted to reference some issues from the past. At the Coastal Commission meeting of October 9th, 2024, the Executive Officer of State Lands spoke of the requirement that the city manage tidal lands fairly and equitably. However, the city sought mooring rates of up to 400%, their rate increases, thereby highlighting the significant rate discrepancies between mooring permits and residential pier leases. In response to questions from the Coastal Commission that day, the executive officer also indicated that State Lands has appraisers on staff and the expertise and professionals to do a deep dive on late land management operations of the city, and there is an appallingly incredible discrepancy between pier or dock rates and the mooring rates, and the amount of tidal lands utilized by residential piers and associated vessels is significantly larger than the amount of tidal lands utilized by moorings and moored boats. In addition, she recognized that there's a real definite inequity going on and that State Lands Commission mooring buoy rates are much lower than residential pier rates. Those of us who cannot afford to keep boats at land-attached docks just do not understand why the city makes us pay more rent than almost every other tidal lands user, even most commercial ones, for our spaces that cannot be accessed without the use of additional watercraft, unless one wants to swim out to a mooring. They lack utilities such as water and electricity and are dangerous to access during wind and tide events. Please stop the inequity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker.
Yes, thank you. Our next speaker is Michael Brandon, followed by Samantha McDonald.
Hi, I'm Michael Brandon. And I will also be talking about Newport Beach's discrimination of tidal land users. I would like to thank the State Lands Commission staff for looking into this abuse that Newport Beach has been conducting systematically over the past 10 to 15 years. It's not just the boaters that are being impacted, people that have sailboats like me. It's also people that want to get into boating, the public, all Californians, and even all Americans that wish to use these tidal lands for recreation. There are lots of moorings that are vacant and that could be used to put people temporarily, and it would require good management on behalf of the city. But the city of Newport Beach does not act in the public's best interest. Instead, they create situations of scarcity so that they can justify behaving in certain manners that will strip permittees of their rights and also reduce access to some of the people that need it the most. The working class, the little folk. So I know that there are going to be more people here that will drill on some of those details. So I will keep my talk brief and just say, please help us. Please look carefully at what Newport Beach is doing and side with the little folk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker.
Our next speaker is Samantha McDonald, followed by Christopher Bliss.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Awesome. Hi, my name is Samantha McDonald. I'm a Live Aboard in the Newport Beach Morningfield community. Last year, my partner and I went cruising in Mexico on our sailboat from roughly December to July. We did our due diligence and let the city know that our mooring was available to rent out to whoever the public needed, which is generally what happens when you leave your mooring ball for some time. This is the second time we've done it. We're always happy to help the city and make sure our mooring ball is being used by the public whenever we're not using it. From what we were told by our neighbors, only one boat was ever seen on our mooring ball in the 7 months that we were gone. And that boat was only there for a few days. For the rest of the time, our mooring sat empty. My only guess is that no one needs them because of how expensive the city rents them out for. Newport Beach is so notorious for being overpriced and aggressively unwelcoming that most of our cruising friends that go up and down the coast of the Pacific from Canada, Pacific Northwest to Mexico, skip Newport Beach entirely. And it's really a shame because of how beautiful the Thailands are. But the hostile treatment of boaters to mooring ball holders, and then the way that they're setting up to push us out monetarily is just making it hard to utilize the Thailands for the everyday public. So I really encourage you guys to look into this and really take action to ensure the Thailands are not gifted to just residential pier permit holders who are paying a lot less than us already and are going to continue to do so with this discrimination behavior. Thank you.
Thank you. Katie, next speaker.
Our next speaker is Christopher Bliss, followed by Adam Loverins.
Christopher?
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, hi. Thank you, by the way, for everything that you do. And again, I'm going to speak about the mooring fields in Newport. So here's the first slide showing an image of the moorings about 100 years ago. So the mooring fields, which are organized anchorages, have existed in Newport for about 100 years. They have served mariners well, offering a functioning and affordable option to coastal access and boating for thousands of people. You can put up the second slide, please. On February 5th, despite a supportive staff report, the California Coastal Commission recognized glaring safety issues and overwhelmingly denied the city's request to reconfigure an existing mooring field in Newport Harbor. I believe the commissioners needed to override the staff recommendation because the coastal staff had not conferred with the mooring holders to better understand the nuances of the situation and only got their information from the city. However, after the commission heard 40 public comments, all in opposition, the facts came to light. As the State Lands Commission review continues, we sincerely hope that the commission will reach out frequently to the mooring users for advice, clarification, and inclusion to assure a fair and equitable outcome for the existing mooring holders who have been discriminated against for years. The city of Newport Beach appears to have a two-tiered system when it comes to use of the bay, which belongs to all Californians, not just the wealthy. Newport Beach homeowners and yacht club members do not have to follow the same rules as everyone else and are often given preferential treatment. Private dock owners pay only a small fraction of what mooring users pay for the same tidelands usage. Many private dock owners have commercialized their docks by renting them out at high fees, profiteering off the tidelands. Yacht clubs are given almost twice as much water area with fewer boats, etc. The list is discrepancy on and on. The Newport moorings are an important benefit to us, and we hope they will continue to offer affordable access for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker.
Yes, thank you. Our next speaker is Adam Loverins. We can't see him on the attendee list, so Adam, if you are attending, if you could please raise your hand, and we'll call your name again. So our next speaker will be Jim Palmer, followed by Anne Marie Stenton.
Thank you for this opportunity. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Thanks for this opportunity. I'm Jim Palmer, a mooring permit holder in Newport Beach. I'm here to request that you ensure the current Tidelands Management Grant Review for the City of Newport Beach is a collaborative effort involving all stakeholders, including Newport Beach residents and non-residents, Tideland users, to achieve the best outcomes for everyone. My concern stems from a pattern of over-reliance on the city's appointed harbor commission and other locally connected individuals, which has led to flawed process and poor results. For example, last July, the city voted to increase mooring rents. The vote prompted the state land staff to describe the situation and preliminary findings as, quote, appalling, that there is, quote, real inequity here on a large scale. Also, earlier this month, the California Coastal Commission voted 9-1 to deny the city's long-sought coastal CDP to consolidate some of the mooring fields. In the denial, multiple commissioners noted that user involvement in the process was far less than what should have been done before it came to them before a vote. The city also makes claims that simply don't align with reality. The city says the harbor is 100% full, but on a daily basis, about 100 offshore moorings, roughly 20% of the total, per their own records, are permitted, yes, but are unoccupied and unrented due to the high rental fees that the city charges that artificially restricts affordable access for short-term and transient users. The city says newly created mooring licenses are a solution to replace a century-long use of mooring permits, but the mooring license program appears to be an unlawful seizure of private property without due process, among many other flaws. The city accuses permittees of profiteering through transferability, citing Orange County court actions or similar allegations. But many such abuses, if they did occur, were remedied and resolved in the courts nearly 20 years ago. To ensure the tidelands, your tidelands review process includes not only Newport Beach residents and insiders, but also users who live and vote outside the city. This broader perspective is essential for a fair and effective outcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Anne Marie Stinton, followed by Eileen Boken.
Okay. Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I apologize for the background. I'm a teacher and the kids love this stuff, so I don't know how to change it right
now. They're cute.
Thank you for doing this on my, thanks for doing this on my lunch break. It works out perfect. Hi, my name is Anne Stinton. I'm president of the Newport Mooring Association. Thank you for your efforts to protect working class boaters in Newport Harbor. We are so grateful. We've been dealing with discrimination for years, and we really need your help to ensure this doesn't continue, as you've been hearing from other speakers today. I just want to touch on a few things really briefly. First of all, mooring permittees really deserve equitable treatment. We deserve the same treatment as residential pier permit holders. You know, not only have mooring permittees been charged more for their use of the same tidelands, but dock permittees have other benefits that they are able to have that we don't. For example, they can transfer their permits, which is threatened for us this year, even though we've been able to do it historically. They can rent their docks out for profit, which we're not allowed to do. They're also not subjected to the same vessel inspections required of mooring permittees. Additionally, mooring permittees must carry insurance on their vessels, name the city as an additional insured, while boats at residential piers have no insurance requirements at all. It's just this double standard that we've been dealing with, and we feel it's really unfair. We've been treated like second-class citizens, and we just want the same treatment. Same tidelands, same treatment, please. Second, we would really like there to be more transparency in the permit management in Newport Harbor. This summer, there was a situation where right before holiday weekend, right before the 4th of July weekend, this big change was brought up with no public input to change all of our permits to licenses. Again, no public input, and it blindsided us. So we're looking for that long-term stability. It's been really stressful. The uncertainty surrounding mooring transfers, permit structures, terms, rates, et cetera, you know, it threatens affordable public access to the tidelands. Generations of boaters who have cared for these waters.
Thank you very much for your comments. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Eileen Boken. And then I'd also like to make an announcement. We have a number of attendees wishing to provide comments on Ormond Beach. If you could please hold your comments until we get to the regular calendar item, item 55, that would be great. Thank you.
So just to make sure everyone who's listening understood, the item of Ormond Beach will be coming up later, and we will have a separate comment period for that item. And so we ask that you deliver your comments during that time. That's the way that our bylaws are organized. So we will be hearing from you then. Thank you.
Eileen Boken, Coalition for San Francisco Neighborhoods, speaking on my own behalf. Regarding the sand mining leases in San Francisco Bay, which are up for renewal, The Bay Conservation and Development Commission, or BCDC, is in the final process of reviewing the environmental effects of sand mining. As part of this review, I have strongly urged BCDC to include a cost-benefit analysis. I would strongly urge the State Lands Commission to conduct its own cost-benefit analysis. The U.S. Geological Survey released a study which concluded that sand mining in San Francisco Bay was affecting sediment transport in coastal areas south of the Golden Gate. San Francisco's Ocean Beach has experienced erosion and accretion. In Pacifica, the city of Pacifica, the erosion of coastal bluffs is so severe that homes are literally collapsing into the Pacific Ocean. Pacifica has estimated that managed retreat to deal with this erosion would cost $1 billion with a B. It would appear that the environmental cost of sand mining in San Francisco Bay far exceed the benefits. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker.
Thank you. Our next speaker, we'll return to Adam Lavorenz. I believe that might be a user, if we can allow user to speak and see.
I'm sorry, we can't hear you.
I believe a user should be able to unmute themselves now.
There we go. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I apologize. It would not let me enter my name this time for some reason. Adam Leverance. A slide I have up before you is a Newport Beach Harbor Commission agenda from October of 2022, and it has for discussion what they call the mooring buyback program with a potential of $1 million a year for 30 years. This would have allowed the city to obtain the mooring permits it really wants to have through contractual agreements with willing parties. Next slide, please. About a year and three quarters later, Ms. Stenton just talked about a plan that kind of came out of nowhere for us. The city council proposed to phase out mooring permits and transition them into what they call city mooring licenses. The rates for these are over 13% higher than the current California state benchmark for this area. And they were going to give mooring permittees 4 years, one transfer in that time, and then everything changes to a high-price, short-term city mooring license. The fact that all the value is going to go away in 4 years kind of makes the permits somewhat worthless right now. Next slide, please. For the yacht clubs, however, they were going to give them 8 years, and it says that they will be charged during that time the onshore mooring rates, which are half the price of the offshore mooring rates. Decision makers, the harbor master, influential, powerful people are closely affiliated with the yacht clubs, and the continued exemptions to the policies that are good for me, not being good for them, is extremely troubling. A last ditch effort in November of 2024, they came up with another plan that results in the same thing. I apologize. I'll cover more later in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Garrett Kihata.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. Thank you for holding this meeting today. My name is Garrett Kitahata, and I am a Cal UC Berkeley alum and renewable energy researcher working with America's Green Corps on advancing the mission of a special lab initiated at UC Berkeley. It's a situation developing in Santa Barbara regarding the decommissioning of Platform Holly and Sable's efforts to reactivate the aging Gaviota oil infrastructure. There's an opportunity in California and UC researchers to engage in pioneering a technological peace and conflict resolution strategy that reconstructs non-operational oil infrastructure into something useful like renewable grid and also preserving the marine life on the structure. In particular with Platform Holly, preserving the marine life and making it a research site would be useful instead of taking down the structure and dismantling it. There is supposed to be a decision made on this later this year, and I'm presenting here today on behalf of America's Green Corps because of the interest in preserving this structure and turning it into a sort of monument that would be meant to also honor the offshore ore structures and preserve them in honor of events like the 1969 oil spill, and which was closely connected to Earth Day in 1970. And I'm really in favor of preserving Platform Holly for this potential research and development project. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and go Bears. Next speaker, please, Katie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes our general public comment. We have no other hands raised at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Katie. That concludes our public comment period. The next item of business will be the adoption of the minutes from the Commission's meeting of December 17th, 2024. May I have a motion to approve the minutes in a second?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Any objections to a unanimous vote? If not, the motion passes unanimously. Ms. Cato, will you please conduct a roll call vote?
Commissioner Peralt?
Aye.
Commissioner Cohen?
Aye.
Chair Kunalakis?
Aye. The next order of business is the executive officer's report. Ms. Cato, may we have that report, please?
Thank you so much. I would like to limit my comments to just acknowledge some key personnel changes that have gone on, not only mine here, and ask that any interested party please refer to the full executive officer's report on our website. There have been a couple of retirements in our Division of Environmental Science Planning and Management. At the end of December, Senior Environmental Scientist Cynthia Herzog retired after more than 14 years with the Commission. Cindy came to us from a private consulting world with a wealth of experience in environmental analysis, particularly with wetland delineations. She quickly became one of the Division's high performers, handling not one but three CEQA documents right after joining the Commission. Cindy's project management portfolio grew to encompass 10 mitigated negative declarations and other CEQA analyses, including review for ExxonMobil Santa Ynez, DuPont, Port Costa, and numerous PG&E natural gas pipeline projects throughout the state. Cindy also built expertise with offshore energy activities, managing CEQA documents, including environmental impact reports for the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station, serving as the Commission's environmental lead for the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, and culminating as project manager for the Rincon Phase 2 decommissioning project, EIR. While working on Rincon Phase 2 project, Cindy spent countless hours skillfully managing consultants and working with the Commission staff to develop the feasibility study, craft complex project description and alternatives, effectively engage in public and tribal outreach, navigate countless technical, political, and legal hurdles, and artfully negotiate with partner agencies and stakeholders. Even though she had found a niche with offshore oil and gas, Cindy never shied away from tackling on new projects in different environments. She was our agency's lead on the ill-fated deepwater desal project in Monterey Bay, which required her to quickly learn a new technology and lead a multi-agency team to evaluate a novel approach to desalination. Cindy would regularly accept challenging assignments and deliver outstanding results. Cindy would work regularly to let her supervisor know that she needed more work if she found herself with time on her hands. We are very happy and proud to have had Cindy on our CEQA team for these years. She brought both a keen intellect and a genuine passion for her work. Cindy cared about what she was doing and why she was doing it, and she contributed much to our environmental division. Cindy will be missed, but we are excited for her many new adventures ahead. In January, Environmental Program Manager Jennifer Maddox retired after more than 25 years of service to the state of California, including almost 15 years with the Commission. Jennifer started her career as a scientific aide with the California Department of Fish and Game, where she rose through the ranks and served as the statewide coordinator for the California Endangered Species Act permitting program. She transferred to the Commission in 2010 and immediately distinguished herself as the project manager for the complex and controversial 2012 PG&E Diablo Canyon Power Plant High Energy Seismic Survey Environmental Impact Report.
Wow.
Jennifer's work was foundational to the Commission's renewable energy program as she represented the Commission in the development of the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan. Her innovative work and strong leadership led to the passage of Assembly Bill 982, and a 2015 Memorandum of Intent with the Bureau of Land Management to establish a state process to facilitate land exchanges with the federal government for renewable energy development. Jennifer became the Commission's science policy advisor in 2015, ensuring that the best available science informed the Commission's decisions for protection of the environment and management of state lands. And Jennifer diligently represented the Commission in interagency science and policy working groups and task forces. She was integral to the creation of the Climate Adaptation Program at the Commission, developing it in collaboration with the many California Sea Grant Fellows she mentored to ensure the Commission prepares state lands to be resilient to climate change impacts for generations to come. Jennifer also served as the Commission's first tribal liaison and was the lead author of the Commission's tribal consultation policy that serves as a statewide model for integrating tribal outreach, engagement, and consultation into agency actions, and now serves as the lens through which all Commission activities are considered. Jennifer played a fundamental role in protecting the public trust, resources, and values at Owens Lake through her passion, tenacity, and never capitulating to corporate pressures. And Jennifer's leadership and unconventional thinking resulted in major changes in how the Commission engages and consults with the tribes of the Owens Valley. Jennifer was also the Commission's lead and critical catalyst in developing the opportunity and implementing the return of 40 acres of land in Inyo County to the Lone Pine Paiute Shoshone Reservation to preserve and protect tribal cultural resources. She further spearheaded a map amendment to the National Register of Historic Places that would add 480 acres in the Bodie Hills to the Dry Lakes Plateau Archaeological District. In more recent years, Jennifer has assisted with the establishment of the Division of Environmental Science Planning and Management in 2023 and led the division's Climate Adaptation and Special Initiatives team, guiding important program areas, including the Commission's Forestry Program, expansion of the Commission's renewable energy portfolio to include offshore wind, and advancement of the Commission's contributions to critical conservation and adaptation policy actions such as 30 by 30 and the state adaptation strategy. We will miss Jennifer and the passion she has for environmental protection, her directness and willingness to speak her mind, her no-nonsense attitude, and her deep care and concern for her staff. We hope that Jennifer's retirement is filled with many happy camping trips to the desert, mountains and lakes that she loves, spends time on the beach in Maui, eating delicious meals and fine chocolates, nursing orphaned kittens back to health, and spending time with her daughters. And then with the Commission's indulgence, I would like to just turn this over to Seth to have him acknowledge another key party for us.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioners. I am honored today to recognize Deputy Attorney General Matthew Hine. Matthew Hine was the Deputy Attorney General who was assigned to the Plains All-American lawsuit that we brought. A little bit of background for Matt. Matt, over 10 years, worked for Kleetushin, Bogdanoff, and Stern LLP as a litigator in private sector, and put on his white knight hat and came to the state in 2014. Shortly thereafter, I made a fateful call in 2018 to the Attorney General's office saying, hey, I've got an idea about how to hold Plains All-American Pipeline liable. And after a few people said, no way, this can't possibly happen, I met with Matt and his colleague, Yan Vu, and they said, this sounds really exciting, and how do we do this? So over the intervening 6 years, Matt has, Yan, by the way, went on and became a judge. He is now a judge in Superior Court in Los Angeles. But Matt put a lot of work in, a lot of sacrifice over the last 6 years. And it, like I said, it is my absolute honor to recognize that we should be commending Matthew for his incredible dedication and work over the past 6 years on this litigation in favor of the Commission and the people of California for helping secure a settlement from Plains All-American Pipeline of $72.5 million, 50.5 of which went back to the California General Fund to help offset the expenses associated with safely plugging and abandoning Platform Holly. Matthew is an exemplary Deputy Attorney General who gave everything to his client, quite literally, in terms of his time. He did not take any vacations for 6 years. The Commission, and we hereby thank him and wish him well in what will undoubtedly continue to be a distinguished record of professional public service to the state of California.
Wow. Those are three pretty extraordinary people we're recognizing today, Grace and Seth.
Agreed.
Definitely. Do we want to do photos? Do we want to do that now? If we can invite Matt and
Jennifer? Maybe first can we just...
absolutely.
We as commissioners may want to say a few words. There's so much there to unpack, so many accomplishments. I just want to start with Cindy and Jennifer and your incredible years of dedication and some really extraordinary accomplishments. Things are coming to my mind just over the last 6 years. You will be missed, but it sounds like you have some pretty wonderful plans for the next phase, the next chapter. I'm a little jealous, I'll tell you, as I was listening to what you have planned for your free time. The commission staff, and the people of California will always live with the benefits of the work that you did during your time here, and we're very grateful and thank you for that. And Matthew, there he is. I shudder at the thought that you were not even taking a day off during the course of that lawsuit, but I believe it because it was very difficult and the outcome was extremely beneficial again to the people of California who we serve. So thank you very much. And with that, I'd like to hand it quickly over to Commissioner Cohen to say a few words if she'd like to add to those comments, and then we can take some pictures after.
Thank you very much. My message is very simple. Congratulations. You've worked very hard. You've earned this time. This is a moment to celebrate. This is a huge transition, and I look forward to joining you one day.
Don't hold your breath. Commissioner Perrault.
I'll just continue to echo the congratulations and the thank you for the hard work. I will say this to both of you. You know, public service is not for the faint of heart. I know it is something that you could be making a lot more out in the private sector in a lot of ways, depending on what you're doing. But it is because of folks like you who step up and understand the value that public service provides, not just to the commission specifically, but to the state of California, that's important. And I would just say specifically related to, a wonderful outcome on our lawsuit. I also am very sorry to hear that you did not take any time off. That's not great. But I do want to thank you because it sounds like we went down the road of trying to get partners to move the ball on this forward. And it takes folks like you to take a chance and say, I think we can do this, that in the end is a win for all of us. So, again, thank you, and I appreciate both of your, those of you that are here, but both of your services. And for those of the two of you retiring, I wish you good luck. And I also hope to get there, but it'll be a while.
We'd love to take some pictures. Does that conclude your report, Ms. Cato?
That does conclude my report. Thank you, Chair.
Katie, do we have any public comments for the executive officer's report?
We do have one hand raised on Zoom, so I'll call on Rosalind Tovar.
Please proceed with your comment.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Rosalind Tovar, and I'd like to speak on agenda item 55.
We're not at agenda item 55 quite yet. Could you wait until we get to that item, and we will have a public comment period then?
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, is that all, Katie?
Yes, that's all. Thank you.
All right. The next order of business will be the adoption of the consent calendar. Commissioners, are there any items that you would like removed from the consent calendar? Okay. Ms. Cato, are there any items that have been removed from the consent calendar?
Chair Kunalakis, there have been no items that are removed from the consent agenda.
Okay. We will move forward. May I have a motion to adopt the consent agenda and a second?
So moved.
We have a motion by Commissioner Perrault and a second by Commissioner Cohen. Unanimous vote or roll call? What are we doing?
I think roll call.
Roll call vote.
All right.
Ms. Cato?
Commissioner Perrault?
Aye.
Commissioner Cohen?
Aye.
Chair Kunalakis?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you. The next order of business will be the regular calendar. Okay, I see. Oh, I'm sorry. That was supposed to be a comment for item 55. That's on the consent calendar.
We can go ahead and take the item 55 now.
But we already voted on the consent calendar.
54 and 55, I believe, are informational items. They are real estate negotiations where we will go into closed session.
Should we take them now or before closed session?
We can take them now prior to going into closed session.
Okay, all right. Katie, then why don't you go ahead and proceed? And if anyone out there has a comment on items 54 and 55, which are informational items, so we will not vote on them during our public meeting, but if you have comments on either of those items, we will take that now.
Thank you. So for our first speaker, we have Aurora Ruggiero, followed by Hina Singh.
Okay. Please proceed.
Hello, commissioners. My name is Aurora. I am a resident of Oxnard, and I am representing COST today and the Regenerate Coalition. I am here today to urge you to reject the lease amendment for the conduits for the Ormond Beach Generating Station. I also ask that the decision-making meeting for this amendment be held in South Oxnard during an evening time to make it accessible for Oxnard residents to participate in the meeting. I look forward to commission staff coming to Oxnard this Friday to listen to our community and include our perspectives in the environmental justice analysis. Before commissioners vote on the amendment, I request that community members are given at least 30 days to review a draft of the EJ analysis to be able to provide edits or suggestions to ensure comments from community engagement meeting accurately reflect the community. I'm hopeful to see the steps the commission will take to continue to increase accessibility to communities impacted by decisions commissioners make, and look forward to seeing more opportunities for community members to provide input and engage with the commission so that their perspectives are reflected in the policy and decisions that impact their daily lives. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Hina Singh, followed by Julia Dowell.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Hina Singh. I am a resident of Culver City, and I'm here today on behalf of the California Environmental Justice Alliance, or CEJA, and the Regenerate California campaign. Today, I want to urge you to do three things. One is to reject the lease amendment extending the lease term for seawater intake and discharge conduits at the Ormond Beach Generating Station. Two is to allow at least 30 days for community members to provide their input on the environmental justice analysis that's currently in progress, especially given that this is the first time the commission is tasked with completing an EJ analysis. And three is to hold the decision-making meeting for this lease in the city of Oxnard during evening hours to accommodate folks that are working during the day. And just to provide some more background on Ormond Beach, this is a generating station that was extended from 2020 to 2023, and again from 2023 to 2026 by DWR and CEC on the grounds of providing reliability during grid emergencies. But the Regenerate Coalition has proven that this is really a myth. We put out a report back in 2023 that looked at how hundreds of gas plants, including Ormond Beach, operated during the 2022 heat waves. And it was found that Ormond Beach was running at full capacity, emitting 13 times more pollution than the baseline. And in the end, it failed to produce electricity during peak demand hours. So not only is this plant not running reliably, it's causing pollution and harm to working class communities of color that are already burdened by poor air quality from the nearby industry and port operations. And furthermore, once-through cooling systems like Ormond Beach are known to harm marine ecosystems by exposing them to thermal stress. And it's also providing potential harm to one of the last remaining wetlands in Southern California. So we see that Ormond Beach has burdened Oxnard residents for years, and we ask that you reject the lease and ensure communities are part of the process by providing at least 30 days for us to review the EJ analysis before it goes to the commission for vote. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Katie, may we have the next speaker, please?
Yes, our next speaker is Julia Duell, followed by Tyler Valdez.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Julia Duell, and I am speaking today on behalf of Sierra Club and the Regenerate California Coalition. So I first want to ask the commission to please reject the lease amendment extending the lease term of lease 4196 for seawater intake and discharge conduits at the Ormond Beach Generating Station. I also want to urge the commission to allow for at least 30 days for community members to provide input on the environmental justice analysis and hold the decision-making meetings for this lease in the city of Oxnard during an evening time to accommodate Oxnard's majority working class community. I want to touch on some of the very critical environmental justice and health impacts of the Ormond Beach Generating Station. The generating station is located in a census tract where communities of color experience pollution worse than 94% of the communities in the state. In the State Lands Commission's environmental justice policy, it recognizes the urgency of addressing environmental injustice, especially as impacts of climate change disproportionately affect disadvantaged communities like Oxnard. For years, community members in Oxnard have fought for clean air and coastal accessibility. And in 2017, the community of Oxnard fought hard to reject the proposed Puente power plant. The fight continues for the transition to renewables and the retirement of the Ormond Beach Generating Station. We were promised that this gas plant would be shut down in 2020 and then again in 2023. So again, I urge you to reject the lease amendment extending the lease term for lease 4196 for seawater intake and discharge conduits at the Ormond Beach Generating Station. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. Katie, next speaker, please.
Our next speaker is Tyler Valdez, followed by Rosalind Tovar.
Hi, good afternoon, commissioners. This is Tyler Valdez, also with CEHA, the California Environmental Justice Alliance. And I'm here today showing up in solidarity with CAUSE and the Oxnard community, asking you to reject the lease amendment for lease 4196 to allow at least 30 days for a community to provide input and review on the EJ analysis and to hold the decision-making meeting in Oxnard during a time that's accessible for their working class community. And to reiterate some points that my colleagues have already shared, Oxnard families deserve safe access to the coast and clean air and shouldn't have to worry about the Ormond Beach Generating Station turning back on to power faraway urban centers. As a reminder, this plant was slated to retire in 2020 and in 2023, but had its contract extended twice. And if the state had kept its promises, then the community should have already celebrated and began seeing the decommissioning of this plant, similar to the one in Redondo Beach, which is a wealthier and wider coastal community just down south on PCH. And last year, OBGS was not needed for a grid emergency. And with even more clean energy and energy storage projects coming online this year, it's becoming increasingly unnecessary and costly to taxpayers to maintain this obsolete and unwanted power plant. And as CAUSE and the community has called it before, OBGS is a zombie OTC gas plant that keeps coming back to haunt them. So please help them to get rid of this plant for once and for all by rejecting the lease amendment for lease 4196. And I'll end by thanking the commission and the staff, especially Jessica Ramirez, for listening to the community and by hosting this community engagement meeting in Oxnard this Friday. I commend the commission for being responsive and walking the walk of implementing your agency's EJ policy, but the work is not over just yet. We ask for your continued collaboration during this process and for you to truly listen to the community's request. Thank you.
Thank you. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Rosalind Tovar.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Rosalind Tovar, speaking on item 55. I'm a resident of Los Angeles, and I'm here today on behalf of Communities for a Better Environment and Regenerate Coalition. I urge you to reject the lease amendment extending lease 4196 for seawater intake and discharge conduits at the Ormond Beach Generating Station. Allow at least 30 days for community members to provide input on environmental justice analysis and hold a decision-making meeting for this lease at the City of Oxnard scheduled during the evening to accommodate Oxnard's predominantly working class community. As someone who works closely with community members in Wilmington, a poor and environmental justice community in Los Angeles, I've witnessed firsthand how communities face pollution burdens similar to those experienced in Oxnard. Communities near ports, refineries, and heavy diesel traffic suffer some of the worst, and gas plants suffer some of the worst air quality in the state, causing chronic health conditions like asthma, cancer, and cardiovascular diseases. This should not continue to be normalized. The Ormond Beach Generating Station is located on a census tract where communities of color experience pollution worse than 94% of the community statewide. The State Lands Commission's own environmental justice policy recognizes the urgent need to address these inequities, especially as climate change disproportionately impacts disadvantaged communities like Oxnard. Furthermore, during the 2022 heatwave report, Ormond Beach Generating Station operated at full capacity, emitting 13 times more pollution at its baseline, yet failing to provide electricity during critical peak hours. It is critical that you reject the amendment for lease 4196 and ensure meaningful community engagement through an adequate time for input and holding decision-making meetings in Oxnard at an accessible time. Through this decision, the State Lands Commission has approved protect and prioritize environmental justice communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Katie, next speaker.
Thank you. We have no other hands raised for this item.
Okay. Then we will move on to the regular calendar. Item 56 is an update on state legislation relevant to the California State Lands Commission. May we please have the staff presentation? Hi, Sherry.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Kunalakis and commissioners. Staff's not recommending any action today. This is just a brief summary of highlights I wanted to touch on of the legislative session so far. Legislators capped, or the Assembly and Senate capped, the number of bill introductions this year, so we expect about a 25% reduction over the two-year session. Although, as of the deadline last Friday, legislators have introduced around 2,300 bills, which is more than in past years. So we will see what happens in 2026 and maybe less bills.
What
then.
Was the cap number? Do you remember?
I think it was around 1,400 in the Assembly, and I will have to check on the Senate. I think it's about 35 total for Assembly members over the two-year span. And I'll follow up on the Senate.
Oh, that's all right.
About 40% of the bills introduced so far are spot bills or intent bills, so we'll be monitoring those in the coming weeks as we approach the deadline for those bills to be amended in mid-March and move toward the April committee hearing deadlines. As you can imagine, a lot of bills are directed at recovery efforts from the catastrophic Southern California wildfires. Wildfire prevention, recovery, and emergency response and disaster assistance are big priorities this year. Wanted also to report back that staff has secured legislation following or implementing a recommendation in the Marine Invasive Species Program report that the Commission approved last December, and that's to change the report timeline from biennial to triennial, and also put in requirements that staff post on its website information about vessel arrivals, enforcement, and inspections so that data is still transparent and accessible, despite the longer duration between when the report is provided to the legislature. And that legislation will be in a Senate Natural Resources and Water Committee bill that will be introduced in the coming days or weeks and will be considered an official commission-sponsored bill. I also just wanted to highlight a few bills introduced to date that touch that affect the commission and that we'll be doing analyses on in the coming weeks. And then more generally, we'll be coming back in April with updates on all of these bills and other bills. Bills I wanted to touch on are AB 526 by Assemblymember Pappin that would require the state to create a strategic plan for new in-state geothermal energy development. It would have the State Lands Commission in a consultation role supporting the Energy Commission and other agencies, and then also require the commission to look at its royalty and rents for geothermal leasing. And potentially reduce those rates depending on the findings in the strategic plan. Another bill I wanted to touch on is AB 406 by Assemblymember Bennett that would require the Energy Commission to collaborate with the State Lands Commission and ports as it evaluates ways to change the marine infrastructure to support alternative fuels and moving non-petroleum products through our infrastructure. Also wanted to touch on AB 1448 by Assemblymember Hart, who represents the Santa Barbara area. This bill would ban the State Lands Commission from issuing a new lease that authorizes the construction of oil and gas-related infrastructure in connection with federal leases for offshore oil and gas. It would also impose conditions on the commission's consideration of any lease amendment involving oil and gas infrastructure on state lands that's associated with a federal offshore oil and gas lease. Other bills more generally we are reviewing involve efforts to facilitate alternative fuel use, creating artificial reefs or leveraging them as mitigation, designating state surfing reserves, combating greenhouse gas emissions, a kind of polluters pay type of program, carbon capture, removal, and utilization, and creating a financial assistance program for climate catalyst projects to decarbonize heating and power use at industrial facilities. So we'll be looking at those and others, also efforts to reduce plastic pollution. The commission has any particular bills or issues they want to direct staff to prioritize, of course, we'll be happy to do that. And then I anticipate coming back on April 2nd with potential recommendations for the commission to take positions on legislation.
Okay. Well, the ones that you've identified already are certainly ones we're going to want to hear how they move forward. All right. Commissioners, do you have any comments or questions? All right. This item is informational, so no vote is required. Do we offer public comment on that? I think we do. Yeah, I'm sorry. Katie, is there anyone who would like to speak on the informational item number 56?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have no one signed up to speak on this item.
Okay, very good. Then we will move on to item 57, which is to consider approval of proposed emergency rulemaking amendments to sections 2292 and 2293 of the California Code of Regulations, Title II, Division III, Chapter 1, Article 4.7. May we please have the staff presentation? Hello, Jonathan.
Hello. I have to say that all again, too. Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Jonathan Thompson, a senior environmental scientist with the Commission's Marine Invasive Species Program. I'm here today to present item 57 and recommend approval of the proposed emergency rulemaking amendments to California's ballast water discharge performance standards in Article 4.7 of the California Code of Regulations. Next slide. The California Marine Invasive Species Program is a multi-agency program designed to reduce the risk of introducing non-indigenous species into state waters from vessels that are 300 gross registered tons or greater and capable of carrying ballast water. The Marine Invasive Species Program's purpose is to move the state expeditiously toward eliminating non-indigenous species discharges into California waters. As part of meeting this goal, the Commission implements regulations that require vessels discharging ballast water in California waters to meet ballast water discharge performance standards. These performance standards set limits for the allowable concentration of living organisms in discharged ballast water. The shipping industry uses ballast water treatment systems to meet these standards. As the shipping industry has moved to comply with these standards, ballast water exchange has been replaced by ballast water treatment as the main ballast water management method. Next slide. What is the emergency? On October 17th, 2024, the golden mussel, an invasive freshwater mussel, was discovered in the port of Stockton. This species poses a significant immediate threat to the ecological health of the Delta, California's water infrastructure, and California's fresh and brackish water environments. Golden mussels were likely introduced as a result of ballast water discharges at the port of Stockton, which is a freshwater port. The discovery of the golden mussel invasion, coupled with the shipping industry's transition from ballast water exchange to ballast water treatment, exposed a critical gap in existing state and federal regulations for vessels carrying fresh or brackish water and discharging at California's fresh and brackish water ports. This transition to performance standards was intended to more reliably and consistently manage ballast water to reduce the likelihood of introducing non-indigenous species. However, ballast water exchange, which replaces lower salinity water with higher salinity ocean water, is an effective means of killing fresh or brackish water organisms. Transitioning away from exchange and toward discharge performance standards likely results in higher concentrations of fresh or brackish water organisms in ballast water than would be expected with exchange. This results in a greater likelihood of introducing fresh or brackish water species. Next slide. To address this critical gap in ballast water management, vessel arrivals that...
You know, can I just stop you right there?
Yes.
Just to clarify? So you're saying that what probably happened in Stockton is that a vessel coming in that wasn't required to manage ballast water the way we require it at the seaports went to a freshwater port and likely discharged ballast water there? And is that what you're saying, that we think is likely that that happened?
We're not exactly sure, but the likely mode, and even though it's in freshwater, Stockton is still a port,
mm-hmm.
That has the ocean going vessels. So yeah.
So it could have happened. Is what we're saying, that could have happened. And so what we're talking about is, okay, so I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure I clarified that that's what you were kind of implying with the Stockton example.
Yeah, it's and just a little bit more background on the golden mussel. Mm-hmm. It's the first introduction into North America, so that's partly why we think that the introduction was as a result of ballast water.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so to address this this gap in ballast water management, vessel arrivals that would be subject to these proposed regulatory amendments would be required to exchange ballast water at or beyond 50 nautical miles from land. The exchange ballast water would still need to comply with the discharge performance standards and would need to be at a salinity of at least 30 parts per thousand, which is essentially ocean salinity. Based on the best available science, these regulations will decrease the risk of introducing invasive species like the golden mussel in fresh and brackish water environments. Next slide. These new requirements would impact an estimated 63 to 79 vessel arrivals per year out of the roughly 10,000 vessel arrivals that we see annually. I think there's a, this is an older version of the presentation. It says 36 up there, and it should be, 63 to 79. These emergency regulations would require an exchange to be conducted for the following vessel arrivals. Arrivals carrying fresh or brackish water, and more specifically ballast water that is less than 18 parts per thousand salinity. Arrivals discharging at ports within San Francisco Bay Delta from the port of Rodeo east to the ports of Sacramento and Stockton. This includes all of California's fresh and brackish water ports. Next slide. If approved by the commission, the next step would be to post a public notice for at least 5 working days. Unlike traditional rulemakings, this notice does not start the public comment period. It instead it provides notice to the public that the commission is beginning the emergency rulemaking process. Once the 5-day notice period has elapsed, the emergency rulemaking action will be submitted to the California Office of Administrative Law, or OAL, for their review. OAL's review is 10 calendar days and includes 5 days for public comment, which also includes a public notice on the Commission's website. The regulations will be effective once approved by OAL and filed with the California Secretary of State. Next slide. These emergency regulations would be effective for 180 days with up to 2 90-day extensions. In order to make the requirements permanent prior to the expiration of the emergency regulations, Commission staff are already preparing a regular rulemaking package. In addition to making the regulations permanent, the regular rulemaking includes a full 45-day public comment period and an additional opportunity for the Commission to review and improve the regulations. Next slide. Staff recommends that the Commission approve the proposed emergency regulations that, if approved by OAL, would amend sections 2292 and 2293 in Article 4.7, Title 2, Division 3, Chapter 1 of the California Code of Regulations. Next slide. Thank you for your consideration, and staff is available for questions.
Okay, we're going to do public comment and then commissioner comments and questions. So, Katie, do we have anyone who would like to speak on item 57 at this time?
Yes, thank you. So far, we have 2 speakers signed up. First is Jacqueline Moore, followed by Karen McDowell.
Yes, good day, Chair, Lieutenant Governor Kunalakis. I'm Jacqueline Moore of the Pacific Merchant Shipping Association's PMSA. I'll be short, but firstly, I wanted to share that we greatly appreciate the longstanding and collaborative relationship with State Lands and the MISP staff. It's not often we can say such things, so I always try to give kudos when they're due. Now, we did already submit a short letter to the commission, just really memorializing rights of navigation and state water limit. But I did want to call attention to really our one appeal here, which is to revise one definition to include some standardized safety language. It's a small but important action. So that's it for this item, but we've already already had some supportive response from staff. So again, very appreciative of that collaborative relationship there. And now a bit out of order, but I did want to take just a second to share that I've already indicated our legislative support for the state lands effort to alter the timing of that invasive species report that you heard about in the previous bill is previous item, excuse me, and also sponsoring the Caballero bill that you heard of as well. So look forward to collaborating on that. And that concludes my comments. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Karen McDowell.
Hi, my name is Dr. Karen McDowell, and I'm writing in support of Agenda Item 57. I'm a senior environmental specialist at the San Francisco Estuary Partnership, which is part of the National Estuary Program. I also serve as an ex officio member on the Federal Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force, and have been working on invasive species since 1999, including managing the West Coast Ballast Outreach Program for 5 years. 1999 was right when the Commission was launching its Marine Invasive Species Program, which has become a world leader in developing and implementing regulations that have had positive impacts on reducing the likelihood of species introductions from commercial shipping activities in California and across the globe. In the Estuary Partnership's 2022 Estuary Blueprint, our strategic management plan, Task 15-1 states that we should maintain, expand, and improve invasive species prevention programs, which includes managing ballast water discharge from commercial vessels. As you know, ballast water regulations started with requiring open ocean exchange and has shifted to the ballast water treatment with the adoption of the discharge standards. We all know that ballast exchange and treatment are complicated with respect to the fresh and brackish water. Exchange with ocean water also works as a very effective treatment, since the species that would survive in low salinity waters would be killed by the salty ocean water. In light of this information and the recent detection of the invasive freshwater golden mussels in the Delta, time is of the essence to adopt the proposed emergency rulemaking. Action, item number 57. This will put additional protections on discharges of fresh and brackish ballast water into California's ports, which is critical for protecting these waters from new invasive species introductions. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Katie, any other speakers on this item?
Thank you. We do not have any other speakers for this item.
Okay. Jonathan, I have a couple of questions. So first, how long have we been aware that our regulations around ballast water that impacts ships coming into our coastal ports have not applied to ports further inland in fresh and brackish water ports?
Well, the regulations have applied to the freshwater ports. Right now, the regulations require the vessels to meet performance standards. That is, as I mentioned in my presentation, it's an allowable concentration of organisms in the discharge and typically using the treatment system. So vessels have had to comply with those regulations. Prior to that, we did require exchange, but there was a paradigm shift. From exchange to
if they're required to comply, then what went wrong?
That
Chris, do you want to? We have our sure. Chris may be able to provide some additional information on the.
Thank you.
Yeah, hi, Chris Shawney, Environmental Program Manager. So, when we switched over, state, federal, international, switched over from ballast water exchange to ballast water treatment.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
For us, it was 2022, so just in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And it was a stepwise implementation, so it's been slowly through since then.
Right.
So the idea was we were replacing a method that reduced the number of organisms by exchanging port water that had high concentrations with low concentrations in the middle of the ocean. It was great for marine-to-marine ballast water discharges. Mm-hmm. For freshwater to freshwater or brackish to brackish discharges, it took where we were before with ballast water exchange, the salt water pretty much killed everything that was mm-hmm. in the water. So that was an effective management tool. By switching over to a treatment, now they're treating the water, they're no longer putting salt water into the tanks. So it still is killing the majority of the organisms, but just slightly more.
Okay. So the treatment process has just not worked as well. when it comes to the release of ballast water in freshwater ports.
Yeah, so the transition, that regime change, was beneficial from marine to marine and not quite as beneficial for the freshwater to freshwater.
Okay, and then my second question then is, in order to comply, how are the people who are, you know, the ship companies, that, like, what are they saying that this is something they think they'll be able to readily comply with?
So ballast water exchange has been the management method since 2000 all the way up until 2022. So every vessel is able to do ballast water exchange without doing any configuration or making any changes to their
system. So we're going to have them go back to the system that they were using previously.
And it would be both. So it would be both exchanging in addition
and
to
treating.
Meeting the standards. And
okay.
To do that, they would have to treat.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Can I just make one point that this, what we're proposing, will be a part of federal regulations in a couple of years once the Vessel Incidental Discharge Act goes into effect. It's already part of that rule. So
I see.
We're just trying to close this maybe two-year gap.
Okay. Final question. Can you briefly tell us what the situation is with the Golden Mussel now in Stockton?
Yeah, so the Department of Fish and Wildlife set up an interagency task force, and our staff has been on a variety of teams within that task force. And we're pretty much about a couple of weeks away from having a statewide response plan. So we've been working with Department of Fish and Wildlife and a lot of other state and federal agencies to contribute to that response plan. Right now, they're in around Stockton and the areas just south of there. The concern is once the water warms up and the breeding season starts, they're going to start seeing more of these spreads. So we're trying to get a handle on this now and contain what we have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Commissioners, does anyone else have a question or comment?
No, but happy to make the motion.
All right. We have a motion by Commissioner Kunkel, a second by Commissioner Peralt. Ms. Cato, could you please call the roll?
Thank you. Commissioner Peralt?
Aye.
Commissioner Kunkel?
Aye.
Chair Kunalakis?
Aye.
Motion passes.
All right. Wow. Thank you very much for the presentation. Okay. Item 58 is a presentation by staff of the School Lands Forest Information System, Phase 1 Report and Recommendations. May we have the staff presentation, please?
Thank you. Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Dominic Schwab. I'm a senior environmental scientist and a registered professional forester for the Commission's Division of Environmental Science, Planning, and Management. I am here today to discuss Phase 1 of the School Lands Forest Information System, known as the SISTEM. My presentation will highlight elements of the SISTEM Phase 1 report and recommendations that staff have prepared. The report is included as an exhibit to the staff report and is posted publicly on our webpage. Next slide, please. For context, school lands were granted to the state in 1853 by an act of Congress to support public schools. The revenues generated by activities on school lands are put towards the state teachers' retirement fund. There are approximately 4 million acres of school lands, and approximately 34,313 acres of these lands require forest management. Next slide, please. As California experiences increased wildfire risk and frequency due to climate change, understanding how to responsibly manage the state's forests is imperative. State policies, such as the Forest Carbon Plan, set forest management objectives to enhance wildfire resilience and support healthy forests. By understanding fire risk to communities and identifying where forest management and fuel reduction treatment is needed, we can improve fire safety. Understanding important forest characteristics and attributes informs sustainable forest management, including timber management and other opportunities to generate income, conserve wildlife habitat, and understand ecological processes. Next slide, please. A forest inventory can enable staff to implement relevant and important forest management activities to reduce wildfire risk, support revenue generation, and advance healthy forests by providing accurate information about forest attributes and characteristics for a specific parcel. However, developing a forest inventory is labor-intensive and will require field visits and data collection. To manage funding and staff capacity limitations, staff must be able to prioritize where to conduct a forest inventory. Staff developed the School Lands Forest Information System to begin to assist in this prioritization effort. This internal web-based GIS application, developed by staff using existing resources, uses publicly available data to provide information about forested school lands parcels and enables staff to readily visualize, query, and develop data and information reports about forests on school lands parcels. Next slide, please. The 2016 TreeMap data set from the USDA Forest Service is the primary data set in the system, but the system also includes remotely sensed / aerial imagery, data on vegetation types, current year and past year fire perimeters, locations of communities, road systems, and watercourses. Here we have a visual for how this data comes together. Using the system, staff can pull together an overview of forestry information for a school lands parcel, and this is the information for a parcel located in Tehama County. In the upper left, you can see the parcel, and the pixels or polygons on the parcel represent different forest vegetation types and where they occur. To the right is a bar graph that shows how many acres of each forest vegetation type occur on the parcel. The bottom left box has location and identification information about the parcel, and the bottom right box provides forestry data, including the average amount and size of the trees for each pixel or polygon. The data shown in the bottom right box can also be exported to other applications for further analysis. Next, I'll walk through examples of how staff can use this system. Next slide, please. This pie chart is an example of some of the data that can be taken from the system. The five most common forest vegetation types that occur on school lands are California mixed conifer, California live oak, California black oak, blue oak, and pinyon juniper oak woodland. This information is important when making decisions about how to manage a parcel, for example, for timber management or wildlife habitat conservation. Next slide, please. Here we use the system to track the progress of the park fire this past summer to see which parcels could be affected by the fire. The report generated a map of the park fire and all school lands parcels contained in the fire or within 1 mile of the fire perimeter. When we know that commission-managed parcels are impacted by fire, we can prioritize them for site surveys and determine next steps for rehabilitation, such as reforestation. Next slide, please. The system can be used to understand the proximity of communities to forested parcels. In this example, the results show the communities within 5 miles of a particular school lands parcel. Understanding proximity to communities can help staff prioritize parcels for field inventories to assess wildfire risk. Next slide, please. By using the system to evaluate school lands parcels, staff discovered that it would be beneficial to consider managing groups of parcels that are adjacent or within close proximity to each other as management units. Managing groups of parcels which are contiguous has benefits ecologically, for the parcels have similar vegetation, soils, and wildlife, and administratively, parcels fall under the same forest practice rules and other regulations. Based on acreage, available forest health metrics, and proximity to communities, the top five management units to prioritize for further analysis and management are High Peak, Poon Kinney, Salt Creek, Ham Pass, and Mineral. Next slide, please. As previously stated, the data included in the system was assembled using publicly available sources, but was not directly collected from school lands. Staff's next step is to conduct forest sampling, known as a forest inventory, on school lands to help inform forest management decisions. Staff intend to prioritize the top five forest management units for the inventory. System data will inform continued discussions with subject matter experts, such as registered professional foresters, GIS scientists, and other agency professionals to determine efficient data collection methods given financial and staffing constraints. These data will also help staff determine the potential for revenue-generating activities such as timber harvesting. Next slide, please. As we gather more data about school lands parcels and develop management objectives, staff will be better positioned to apply for grants and other funding sources to support land and resource management activities, including costly but critical fuel reduction. We also need to build relationships with neighboring parcel owners, so staff will conduct outreach and use the system to store communications with those neighbors. We also intend to engage with tribes and community members to understand local forest management needs and how we can cooperatively achieve forest management objectives. Taking these steps to address data needs, build a forest inventory, implement management strategies, and enhance coordination with private and public partners will help California's forests become healthier and more resilient in the face of climate change. Next slide, please. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Do we have any public comment on item 58?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have no one signed up to provide public comment at this time.
Commissioners, do you have any comments or questions?
Yes.
Yes, Commissioner Kunkel.
Hi. First, thank you, Mr. Schwab, for the detailed presentation. I think many are, when they think of state lands, the first thing you think of is all the underwater land, mm-hmm. and then you find out about the school lands that are mostly in the desert, and then these forested lands are just, it's kind of a lesser known part of our portfolio. So I'm glad we had this presentation today. So as we all know, and you mentioned in your presentation, school lands are required to be publicly managed to produce revenue for public schools, and CalSTRS and the controller sits on CalSTRS. And I'm just curious, because I'm seeing so many great ideas in your presentation, but I'm seeing like we're looking for funding sources for management, like that's, and you're exploring potential opportunities for revenue generating activities, but are we generating any revenue? Have we ever generated any revenue on these lands?
Can I jump in on that
yes.
one?
Yes.
So sorry. So when the state received the school lands, they did not get to pick and choose which parcels they wanted to receive. So this is part of the entirety of the grouping of school lands that we received. And so we try to generate revenue as often as possible, but in certain areas, especially our forested parcels, there may not be a revenue generating component at yet. We used to have a timber harvesting program that was, I was going to say maybe like, I want to say defunded, but that's not the appropriate word, but put aside because we weren't doing a lot of timber harvesting on our school lands where we were generating revenue. This is the first step in revitalizing a forested lands program. We just brought on Dominic recently, and this is our first kind of look to see where we may have revenue generating opportunities, if possible, but also wildfire management to make sure that we do appropriate clearing in case there are scenarios where we're at risk for wildfire. Because we do not tend to divest ourselves of parcels once we have them, we try to do what we can in terms of minimizing the risk to the state, but also providing revenue to the school lands.
Thank you. Ms. Keto. I still, and I appreciate all the hard work that State Lands is doing on this. This is not a, I guess I understand that this is more of an obligation for the commission, right? And I know in your report, you're planning to assess more opportunities for generating revenue. I hope this doesn't turn into a revenue sink when you know, when we have to spend a lot of money to actually to manage these lands. I was excited to see that there were opportunities for tribal partnerships, that you identified that. Thank you. Are you also considering potential like land back opportunities for this land?
Seth.
Thank you for asking. We do have some limitations on what we can do. The school lands were given by the federal government, subject to a whole entire framework for them. We have an obligation, if we don't either use them for school lands purposes or manage them consistent with the grant, they can actually revert. They can revert back to federal lands. So as a fiduciary, we have to try and figure this out. However, we have been in conversations with certain tribal nations that have interests in potentially purchasing the property. They can purchase the surface estate. We can't sell the minerals, but we can deal with that in other ways. So there are opportunities for this to be used in a way that makes sense. And I think what Grace mentioned earlier with one of the kind of coordinated efforts that we did where we gave 40 acres, well, we facilitated a 40-acre land back to the Lone Pine Paiute and Shawnee Reservation through a Caltrans kind of agreement. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there are some opportunities in that space for continued coordination with tribal governments. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thank you. I'm so glad that that's on your mind.
Yep.
and selling properties is certainly a revenue generation. So we love to hear that at the controller's office. And co-management opportunities too, I think were mentioned in the report. So that's all I have. Thank you so much. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. That was an informational item, so no vote is required. Ms. Cato, what is the next order of business?
Our next order of business is the second public comment period.
Thank you. If anyone would like to address the commission on any matter that is not on today's agenda, please come up to the podium or raise your Zoom hand. We will call on those who are here in person first, and then we will go to those who are joining us virtually. Katie, please call in the first person who would like to make a public comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have no one in person and no one signed up virtually. So no hands raised at this time.
Okay, then that concludes our second public comment period. Do any commissioners have any other comments or questions? All right, then Ms. Cato, what is the next order of business?
Thank you, Chair. The next order of business is our closed session. Before we adjourn into closed session, I do want to call out that items 54 and 55 are on the informational calendar. We've taken public comment on that. Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision C7, allows a state body to discuss real property negotiations in closed session, provided that before the closed session, the state body in open session identifies the real property concerned and the person or persons with whom the negotiator may negotiate. In accordance with this requirement, I announce that the Commission will conference in closed session with its real property negotiators regarding the following items. Item 54 addresses four applications for assignment of leases governing the use of existing offshore oil and gas pipelines traversing state waters associated with the Santa Ynez unit in federal waters, including the Elwood Pier and two mooring buoys. Offshore Santa Barbara County. Negotiating parties are the State Lands Commission, ExxonMobil, Sable Offshore Corporation. Under negotiation are price and terms for lease numbers PRC 4977, 5515, 6371, and 7163. Item 55 addresses an application for the lease for the use of existing intake and outfall conduits associated with the Ormond Beach Generating Station located in Oxnard, Ventura County. Negotiating parties are State Lands Commission and Ormond Beach Power, LLC. Under negotiation are price and terms. That is lease number PRC 4196.
All right, very good. We will now adjourn into closed session. Will the public please clear the room? Thank you. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I call this meeting back to order. Ms. Cato, is there anything to report from closed session?
Consistent with Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision C7, the Commission met in closed session with its real property negotiators regarding the assignment application from ExxonMobil to Sable Offshore Corporation for 4 leases that support the Santa Ynez unit offshore Santa Barbara County, and the application for the extension of the lease for the use of existing intake and outfall conduits associated with the Ormond Beach Generating Station located in Oxnard Ventura County.
Very good. Thank you. So thank you, everyone, for being here to participate. And that concludes the open meeting. We are adjourned.